From Foreign Policy, I'm Sarah Wildman, and this is First Person. This week, Growing Up Gazan. Earlier this spring, tensions between Israel and Gaza escalated yet again. Palestinians fired rockets into southern Israel, and Israel responded with airstrikes.
Israeli rockets struck Gaza overnight on Saturday and into Sunday morning.
This is the deadliest violence between Israelis and Palestinians since 2014.
Israeli missiles flattened multi-story buildings in Gaza City, lighting up the night sky. One building housed the offices of Hamas's leader. The airstrikes were answered by another round of rockets from Gaza.
Israel has imposed a blockade on Gaza since Hamas took control of the coastal strip in 2007. An estimated 50% of Gazans are now unemployed. Clean water and electricity are often in short supply, and many Palestinians are unable to leave the territory. Yusuf Bashir grew up in Gaza, in a home adjacent to a Jewish settlement. At the start of the second Palestinian uprising in 2000, Israeli soldiers moved into the upper floors of his home and used it as a lookout point. They remained there for 5 years. Bashir recounts the ordeal, including being shot by an Israeli soldier and then healed by Israeli doctors and nurses, in a new book, The Words of My Father, Love and Pain in Palestine. Bashir is now an American citizen who advocates for peace between Israelis and Palestinians. He's our guest this week. But at the beginning of your book, you describe a Gaza that sounds like a paradise. Can you tell me about it?
And indeed it was. I grew up on a big ranch, farmhouse, incredible family, incredible parents. I never had to ask twice whenever I needed something. And I thought that I was the happiest, luckiest child ever. Only until 2000, the second intifada took place and things started to go downhill for Gaza. So I like to remind people that Gaza didn't just start out being a terrible place, unlivable, all of that. It's important for me to remind people that there was a prosperous Gaza, and I still believe that it still has chances to become prosperous again and see a better future.
Tell me about a little bit more about the house you grew up in, the land you grew up in. What did it look like when you were a child?
So I have 9 names in my name, and my family has owned the same land that I talk about in the book for the last 300 years, at least. My parents raised tomatoes, eggplants, peppers, and on a large scale, we sold it to Israeli markets and Jordanian markets, sometimes Egyptians as well. But our main customer was the Israeli traders. And my dad on the side, he was very passionate about teaching English. He was one of the most renowned teachers in our town. And at some point, he would become the headmaster of a school that was built by a German friend of his who wanted to support initiatives that will bring Palestinians and Israelis together. And throughout my life, I didn't have that sense of pride and appreciation to the land that he was trying to tell us about. Only until the Second Intifada started and the soldiers who were stationed right behind our house at the settlement of Kfar Darom took over the house. And that's when things, you know, life, my dad, the soldiers would begin to challenge me to think for myself and to take action in order to make sure that I have my chances in life are secure.
So take us to 2000. The Second Intifada begins. And what happens?
The Second Intifada begins. I was 11 years old. I remember in mid-September, the soldiers, for no reason, they stormed the house with waves and waves of bullets. And I remember crawling on the floor, my mom calling on all of us to crawl to the living room because it was the room in the center. So it was the safest one. And to this day, I remember how terrified I was because I've seen the soldiers my entire life, but I never seen them shoot before. And the only calm one was my dad. He comes home and says, "That's okay, it's okay." He hugs everyone and everyone gets a kiss from him and it's fine, it's fine. And then after a couple of days, the soldiers came back and said, "We guess you're not going to leave." So to make the long story short, they leave and then they come back with more guns on each corner of the upstairs area. And from that day on, they would come down at night, move us all to the living room, and then close the doors, disconnect the phones, lock the entire house, and then we'll just listen to, you know, shooting. And in the midst of that, my father, we would sit around on the floor. It's a huge house, and suddenly we are confined to one room.
And how many were you? How many brothers and sisters?
We are eight. And one by one, the oldest siblings would leave to go to Germany. And as the Intifada intensified and would take place for 5 years now, the younger ones kind of experienced it the most. Because my oldest two siblings, they left in 2000 and 2001. The very beginning, so, and then they didn't come back. And then my grandmother as well, who was living with us. And we would end up leaving them behind because we all had to leave the house as a group to go to my dad's school. And my grandmother and my mom would stay behind the house with the soldiers in it. Now, and during the day, they wouldn't be on the first floor. Only at night, or if there's some serious operation taking place in the area or in the neighborhood.
Did they communicate with you in English? What language did they use?
They spoke to my dad in English, mostly, yes.
Tell us a little bit about your father, actually. Tell us his name.
His name is Khalil, which means friend. Mm-hmm. I couldn't describe him and give him justice. He was convinced that a true holy lander would do just about whatever it takes to promote the message and the idea of peace and tolerance in the Holy Land. He believed that it belongs to the Palestinians, it belongs to the Jews, it belongs to the Christians, it belongs to the sons of Abraham. And as a kid, I had a trouble with him because every time he spoke such words, I would have to deal with the soldier, not on TV or in the newspapers, right in front of my eyes in my bedroom, when they forced me to leave my room and go sleep on the floor in the living room. When they disrespect him, when they make up rules just to make his life hard and unlivable in the house.
How did they disrespect him?
They would talk down on him. They would grab him by the collar and shake him, leave, get out, racial slurs. One time he didn't gather us on time, apparently, and the soldier right in front of us, he smashed his head against the wall. And every time, my dad would pretend that nothing happened. I'm still in my house, and they're the ones who are occupying it. I'm not wrong. And tomorrow morning, if any of you doesn't get an A on your exams, don't come to the house. So he was adamant that I'm not going to let the actions of the others define my humanity, because for him, that was the ultimate defeat.
What happened to the land once the soldiers came?
They demolished the greenhouses. They turned this paradise into a desert, basically just sand. The tanks would usually be parked around the house, one in the front, one behind the kitchen. And so every time they drive around, the sand is crushed even more and more and more. So it came to a point that we can breathe it too. And then the farms now were demolished, so the wild grass would grow, and so the passing random herds, kids, Bedouins, all of that would just come. They would be shot at by the soldiers because no one is allowed into the house or the area. And the house was shot at every single day. It was a complicated process to, you know, fix, because every bullet hole had to be done by hand, as opposed to just building a whole house or all that. And the water supply, the well, everything, today it stands, it's built, it's nice. But in 2000 until 2005, they wouldn't even let us fix it. And if we fix it, they would come back and destroy it just to make it annoying for my dad. Because we would have to get a permit every time we had to get someone to come into the house and fix whatever needed to be
fixed.
Was
there a security reason behind the...
I would say yes, but in a very insignificant way, because they knew my dad. I mean, the settlements existed since the 80s, late 80s, and it was the highest house in the neighborhood. So we thought they wanted the house so they can overlook the entire neighborhood. And you can also see all the way to the sea, including the settlement. The settlement was just one floor, and we were three. And we were, like, right there. So they wanted the house. But most of all, inside the house, when we thought, okay, you have the house, you know, we're not going to hurt you or do anything that would go against our principles. Throughout the 5 years, they did things that didn't tell us that they just wanted the house.
Did you have interactions with settlers?
No. The settlers were the most frightening to me. And in the book, I mentioned that they were more scary to me than the soldiers.
Why is that?
They had no regard. I remember them attacking the house. I believe it was 1992. I believe a Palestinian young man killed one of the settlers on his way to the synagogue. And in retaliation, they came to the closest house to them. And that was our house. And I remember the settler hitting my mom, who was pregnant with a twin, on the back of her head. To this day, we talk of it as it happened yesterday. Regardless, though, they never strike me as someone I could just go up to and strike up a conversation about, you know, whatever, anything that's happening in life. The soldiers, however, despite everything, I felt that they were just following orders. Mm-hmm. The settlers, they were just there because they wanted to be there regardless of anyone's beliefs or thoughts.
There was a moment, though, that your father actually was lying in bed and shots go just above his head. And actually, he's hit by shrapnel in his head, but he's low enough in his bed that he is not grievously injured. What happened then?
I believe that was in 2002. A group of CNN reporters came into the house. And at that point, my dad received at least 500,000 letters from people from around the world, including Jewish people who were telling him to stay in the house. And we support you, and we're very much inspired by your message. And the only people who were allowed into the house were the press, who were very much in awe by my dad's convictions and philosophy. So that day, Ben Wiedemann came to do a report in the house. Everything was going fine until the camera woman said, I would like to go upstairs. And when she did, my dad told her, you know, they told me I'm not allowed upstairs. No one is allowed upstairs. And when she did, she told him, it's fine. I'm an American. Should be fine. And she was nothing but fine. They came and they asked for the tape. They told and pointed to my dad that if you want to live, you have to do as I say. And this was all captured on tape. And that night, you know, Ben Wiedemann said, okay, we're done and we'll leave and sorry. And they left. And that night, we thought it was just another crossfire happening. But unfortunately, it was directed at my dad's bedroom. And I thought that I was about to lose him. And when he came the next day, we went to visit him at the hospital. And Ben Wiedemann did too. And he said, yesterday you told us that you will believe in peace no matter what. And then they just almost killed you. And without hesitation, my dad, with a smile on his face, responded and said, what happened to me last night makes me believe even more in peace. If it's not going to be them, let it be me. Because that is my duty, to promote peace in the Holy Land. And I remember asking him why and how. And he said, one day you'll understand. And that day came soon enough.
So you come to become almost used to this. The soldiers are in your house. You live every evening in one room. You're not allowed in your own bedroom. But a major incident happens some years into them being there. Some UN observers come to the house, and your father goes to speak to them. And you came out to talk to them as well, which turns out to be a fateful choice. Tell us what happened that day.
They were talking to the soldiers to get a permit for the UN officers to come in, which they were granted. And it was a week after I just turned 15. I was born on February 9. That day was February 18th. I walked in. You know, I'm a teenager, so nothing is perfect for me. I had a little argument with my mom about leftovers. On my way out to go get my favorite food before it's, you know, curfew time, I decided to sit in and show my dad that I was serious about speaking English and learn, because he was trying to push me that way. And after a couple of minutes, the soldier from the tower said to the UN, it's time to go. And that's what they did. They got up, and as their car was backing away from the driveway, from the house, my dad is in front of me. And as I just waved my hand goodbye to the car, to the UN, one of the soldiers at the tower just shoots me. It was one shot. And from that point on, I thought that was it for me. And my dad would turn around. I remember my mom running, my grandmother attempting to run, and my little brother kicking a chair in anger. And they shoved me into the UN car and onto the hospital. And during the ride, my dad is holding on to my eyes and saying that I wasn't going to die that day. And he was my headmaster and my father, and I was always rebelling against his way of life. So I was apologizing for my grades, for this and for that. And until I got to the hospital, the local hospital, I felt pain like never before, mm-hmm. some of which I feel today. But that's when I realized that I wasn't going to die.
Which hospital did they take you to first?
It was the local hospital in Deir al-Balah Hospital, mm-hmm. and then on to the Shifa Hospital, the mm-hmm. main one in Gaza, and then on to another hospital, which would even add to the whole changing moment in my life, because the third hospital was located in Tel Aviv. And there was my first time to see the Jewish people, the Israeli people, who were not settlers or soldiers. This time, apparently, they are going to save your life, in the words of my father.
Were you afraid to go to Tel Aviv?
I was paralyzed. It wasn't my decision. I opened my eyes and I was in Tel Aviv. I was overwhelmed and very surprised, but I wasn't afraid. They were now dressed in white and telling me which smiley face is your pain level. And that's far less scary than a soldier telling me I couldn't close the door when I went to the bathroom.
Hey, first-person listeners. Join more than 1,000 American and African business and government leaders at Corporate Council on Africa's U.S.-Africa Business Summit this June in Mozambique. Delegates will explore business opportunities in Africa, meet new partners, and advocate to shape U.S.-Africa policy. So far, 10 African presidents will attend, and Secretary Wilbur Ross will lead the U.S. government delegation to the summit. Register now at usafricabizsummit.com. That's usafricabizsummit.com.
How did it change things for you to meet Jews who were helping you?
It liberated me. It made me get closer to my dad. Mm-hmm. Because throughout my experience living under the occupation of the soldiers, I believed that he was the best representation for the Jewish people. It wasn't them, because of everything they were doing. And for the first time, until I was in Tel Aviv, I thought my dad was just hallucinating. Mm-hmm. And then when I was in Tel Aviv, yes, they shot me, but I saw that he wasn't just making up things. I saw that they were human beings, as he was telling me. And they were capable, not just capable of caring, but they would eventually end up saving my life and teaching me how to walk. And that's by far the greatest gift I've ever received in my life. And it just gave me an entire new vantage point to the whole thing that just made me fall in love with my dad and being a Palestinian, but also fall in love with them, because one Israeli shot me, but many were there to save my life. And I think, because it's such a long conflict, we've done a lot of pain to one another. I'm glad that I don't have to hate them just because they're Jewish, just because of who they are. I can disagree with them politically and on other issues, but I don't have to go home every night, sleep, and say, one day I'm going to kill them. That's it. And I think that is the gift of my dad that he gave me, because that would put me on a path of creativity, of peace. My life is not wasted because of him and how he made me think of it. He told me, think of it as an opportunity. He did shoot you for no reason, but you can seek revenge and then that's it, and dedicate your life to that, or you can decide to care about your life first and make something of it that might be of great value to yourself and the world. And that's why I've chosen that, and I hope to continue on that.
Were you angry, though, then?
I was very angry. I was very angry when they took over. I was very angry when they made us, you know, for no reason, they would just do things just to make my dad give up and leave the house. I mean, one night they had us walk around in the middle of the night barefoot. It was cold. And in the end, they would just say, it's a drill. Go home. One time I had to just beg the soldier, let me watch the World Cup final. And he would say, no, no, go to the living room. So I was, and I was shot. I was the one who didn't want to stay in the house. I wanted to go live at my grandmother's. I didn't care about the politics, my dad's convictions and all of that. Not that I didn't respect it, but I was a kid. And I was incredibly angry when the first time I looked at the wound in the middle of my back, I was very emotional, very upset about everything because they told me you're paralyzed and can you lift a few legs? And I couldn't do that. And I did nothing. So I was angry. But my dad saved me my life and saved me from that anger because that anger was going to take over.
And in the hospital, you meet patients who are also Palestinian, who are also Jews. How did that change things for you?
It only added to my new character. I like to say that I was reborn in Israel, in that hospital. The volunteers who are Israeli students from colleges would come and play games, try to like entertain the kids. We were all on wheelchairs. Mm-hmm. My roommate was from a settlement. His dad wasn't welcoming at first. I remember the nurses telling him, hey, he was just shot for no reason.
In the book, you say it was important to you that people know you weren't even throwing stones.
Yes. They would even wave their hand to me if they didn't speak English.
Indicating that you were throwing stones.
Yeah. And always the nurses would like come and say, hey, no, he wasn't. I remember them even hiding newspapers when someone is killed or shot, so I don't have to know what's going on outside. So just because we wanted you to focus on getting better. The volunteers, sometimes random people would come and leave gift bags and candy to the kids. And I remember one time a group of religious Jews surrounded my bed, as they did to every other bed, and they were playing Pesach songs around me. And I remember that I just let them go on for a good half an hour, and then I said, hey, I'm from Gaza. And they just looked at each other and just walked out. A lot of human things happened there that brought me closer to them, but really brought me closer to the whole concept of we have to figure out a way to share this land, because I saw that we, all of us, were capable of doing that.
Your doctors and your providers, your physical therapists, they all are desperate for you to be able to walk again.
Yes, they worked day and night. I remember one doctor mainly was Dr. Prisoner, and I will never forget his face. I mean, he always had a smile on his face, and he always said that you're going to be okay, you're going to walk, you're going to walk, you're going to walk. And every time he said that, in the back of my mind, something tells me, and he's Jewish too. And it's just, I couldn't be more grateful for such an experience because they gave me my life back. Some people say, well, they shot you. That's the least they could do. And that could be true. But I was there. I didn't ask to be there. And they didn't expect to save my life. It just happened. And regardless, who saved my life? It was them. I couldn't change that.
How long were you in the hospital?
I was there for 3 months in surgery and 7 months or so in rehab and physical therapy.
And then you went back to Gaza.
I went back to Gaza walking. I still have my wound. My mom was changing every day. But I looked at the soldiers like my dad did. Children, they're being told to do things in a way, or there's no much accountability on them. But I wasn't afraid of them or concerned with them like I was before they shot me. And every time they, I remember I got up when they took us outside the house, and he said to me, I will shoot you here, right now. And I just looked at him straight in his eyes, and I just turned around and gave him my back to remind him that they already did that, and I'm not worried about that. So it just made me grow up, and I looked at them for the very first time as kids.
You saw the soldiers themselves as kids.
Yes. And kids do things if there's no accountability or a sense of consequence, they get naughty sometimes.
Was there a consequence for the soldier that shot you?
They said they suspended him, and that's all I know. I end the book with a letter to the soldier because I'd like him to know Part of it is to make my dad feel proud because he told me that you should forgive him, not because of him only, but because of yourself. Because if you don't, you're always going to be concerned with him and how you're going to hurt him and all of that. But if you forgive him, it will help you see the light for your own life. And maybe one day he will come back, maybe he will apologize, maybe he forgot, I'm wondering. But I'd like to have the opportunity one day to sit in front of him and tell him about my life and what happened since he shot me for no reason.
The summer of 2005 was the Gaza disengagement. What was it like when they left?
You know, the last week of high school when suddenly no one cares about rules and being serious and all of that, I remember the entire base coming over to the house. At least, I would say, a good 500 of them were all over the house. Because now their base is being brought down, dismantled. And they would leave, you know, a crew by crew by crew by crew. So we were held for a good 2 weeks during that process. We were hearing things and we heard the news before. But, you know, in the Middle East, decisions and promises and deals come and go and nothing happens. So we weren't very optimistic. Only when the last group of soldiers left, we looked around and looked at each other and we ran upstairs for the very first time since 2000. And there were no soldiers, nothing. We would see their trash and things that they left behind. My dad looked at all of us and said, I told you we're going to get the house back. And he didn't take positions, he didn't hate, and he won. And I, to this day, he is the biggest hero, in my opinion, because he didn't give up on his land, but he didn't give up on his identity as a peaceful Palestinian.
You've said multiple times in the book, it's clear that you want to devote your life to the words of your father, who lived in this idea of peaceful coexistence. If you were an elected leader right now, what would you do?
That's a difficult question, because I wanted to dedicate my life to spreading the words of my father. But I believe that I have a vision of my own. I mean, I always wanted to be independent from my father. Today, I'm kind of stuck with my dad, because even when I want to be upset with Israel and everything they do, and they do quite a lot against my people, somehow my dad stands in the way and said, this is your way. Today, as a leader, I would do everything I can to convince other leaders to be as courageous, to make the right things and make things happen, because I believe the Arafat, once upon a time, was considered a terrorist by the West and Israel, and he would end up winning the Nobel Peace Prize. Mm-hmm. I don't think that this word, this terrorism, it should be a way for us to never deal with Hamas or anyone, because at the end of the day, whether we like it or not, they are Palestinians. At the end of the day, whether I like it or not, the settlers are Jews who think that they should live there too. So at the end of the day, whether we like it or not, we have to find a way to respect one another. And if you're convinced that I'm a terrorist, if I'm convinced that you are anti-human rights, it's not possible for us to go into a room and come back making a peace. It has to be a truly genuine deal that respects Palestinians and Israelis. If I'm a leader today, I would try to encourage other leaders to be as courageous as Rabin and Arafat and do the things that people don't expect, but I believe secretly want them to do it, because people at the end of the day want to live in peace and they don't want to fear for their lives, whether they're Palestinians or Israelis.
I'm sort of curious what it's like for you to see when there's a moment of great violence, like in between Israel and Gaza, as there has been over the first weeks of May.
It breaks my heart. It breaks my heart because I feel like I'm attempting to build a beautiful house in the middle of an ocean where it's just impossible. You can build one base and then the water will come, and it's just, you're in the middle of water. And it breaks my heart because I don't want to see Israel suffer, but it breaks my heart even more because I know what the Palestinians have been going through just over the last 10 years, whether that be the leadership in Gaza or the Israeli blockade. And it's, for me, it's only a matter of time. Why are people surprised that clashes are still happening? Why are people surprised and why are rockets coming out of Gaza? Why are the Israelis retaliating? It's designed, the situation we are in right now, it's designed for nothing but clashes now and then. And until we find a solution for Gaza and the situation on the ground, I can't sit here and say, oh, the clashes are not going to happen again.
That was Yusuf Bashir. His new book, The Words of My Father, Love and Pain in Palestine, has just been published. First Person is produced by me, Sarah Wildman, with Benjamin Soloway. Our editor is Rob Sachs. Our executive editor for news and podcasts is Dan Efron. We'll be back next Friday. Thanks for listening.